Live from the special needs entrance of the Performing Arts Center just moments before the Round Here concert, where everything is about to blow up, it's...
The Dark Multiverse of Stephen... The Dark Multiverse of Stephen... The Dark Multiverse of...
Oh my god.
It's the Dark Multiverse of Stephen King, okay?
Okay. First, spoilers throughout. If we haven't made it clear, the Dark Multiverse of Stephen King is an all-spoiler, all-the-time podcast. We assume you know the story, you've read the book or seen the movie or both or whatever. And if not, well, we'll wait right here until you have. So go. Go now. Go ahead. Oh, back so soon? Good. Now, on with the show. The facts on Pet Sematary. Pet Sematary was published by Doubleday in 1983, nominated for a World Fantasy Award a couple of years later, made into a movie from Paramount Pictures in April of 1989, starring Dale Midkiff, Denise Crosby, and the incredible Fred Gwynne. It was directed by Mary Lambert, one of the few female directors of the day, who went on to direct Pet Sematary 2, many other theatrical films and TV and music videos, and in fact, she's still working today. She recently did episodes of The Blacklist and Arrow. It was made for about $11.5 million, and it made more than $57 million at the box office, not to mention something like 35 years of video sales and DVDs and video on demand ever since. You can rent it today on Amazon for as little as $3.99. You can buy it for $4.99. And Michael C. Hall's audiobook version is available through Audible. You can also buy that on a CD if you wanted to. It costs like $30. Anyway, it's not on Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon Prime at the moment, but we'll talk about it anyway. On with the show.
By the way, Judd is going to be played in the remake by John Lithgow.
Oh, I love that.
So we'll see. This guy's been, you know, every time you think he's tapped out, he does something amazing.
No, he does something amazing, yeah. I like John Lithgow a lot.
And there's a weird connection. He was in Dexter.
Yeah.
The best bad guy in Dexter, and then he's going to,
and
Dexter does the audiobook, and now this guy's going to do
it. I love it.
Jason Clark is going to be the doc in it. He was in Zero Dark Thirty, among other things. And Don, so he's,
I don't watch
he looks... He's a normal-looking guy.
Okay, he could be the doctor. Yeah, he could be Lewis.
Yeah, he could be Lewis.
Who would have thought that cutie pie would play the best? I mean, I love Tim Curry, but I mean, would play such a great Pennywise. Not the best, but totally different and totally.
This is the woman who's playing the wife.
Oh, she's perfect because she's just exactly like.
Yeah, they look normal. They look like regular people. They're not going to do movie star stuff.
That's
with
what
them.
I like.
And
I can't wait to see how they do the Micmac Cemetery.
Yeah, her name is Amy Simons, and she's done lots of interesting little things, but nothing big. So this is her big break in a lot of ways. It'll be interesting to see.
How are they going to do the Micmac Cemetery? Are they going to make it look just like this as a nod to how it should be? And oh, I have a question. Okay, so Stephen King is all about Indian burial grounds. Are the Micmacs real Indians?
That's a darn good question. I don't know.
I don't know either.
And no, are they Stephen King Indians?
Yes, exactly. And so when... I had first started taking notes when I first watched the movie before listening to the audiobook, and then I decided, fuck notes, and I ripped everything up and was like, forget about
that's
it. I remember
goal.
That's one of the things that I wrote down was like, are the Micmacs even real? But I was too lazy to get my phone or my tablet out and look it up.
I am now looking it up. And of course, Wikipedia, the only true source that you can believe. They are, in fact, a real live First Nations people indigenous to Canada's Atlantic provinces and the Gaspé Peninsula of Quebec.
Oh, so
as well as
right
the
there.
Northeast region of Maine.
Maine, exactly.
But I think other than that, I mean, I think the King version of the Micmacs is entirely made up.
Yes.
I mean, I don't think he makes any claim to
other Indians. So as we go through and find out other Indians, we'll have to look up and see if they're real tribes or
also,
not.
Also, I think in the book, and it may be mentioned here, is that the Mi'kmaqs ultimately abandoned this area because it was too
yes.
evil.
Yeah.
It wasn't them. It yeah. wasn't, this it wasn't an Indian burial ground.
No, this was,
it was quite the opposite.
Wrong
it was like,
this is like a thinness. This. Yeah, this is like a thinness of reality that
yeah.
they happened to be on, and they were like, we're out of here. Fuck this.
Yeah, the thin places are great. And I think that's my biggest, apart from I think the acting is either very flat
mm-hmm.
or very over the top. It's mm-hmm. like the flat,
right.
but our main characters and over the top. Again, Fred Gwynne being the one exception. There's no build in the movie.
I don't
they
think they had time
the
for in the 80s. I
yeah,
think that it was like, you know, I think that's why a remake is a good idea because they can make it 2 hours, 3.5 hours long, and they can make it amazing.
Yeah,
you know?
And it was like this that beautiful yeah. scene with Lewis going up flying a kite with his boy.
Yeah.
That ends well. It doesn't
it
end with a death.
Which
like,
I was so scared when I was listening to the audiobook because I had watched the movie beforehand, and I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah,
oh,
this
no.
is going to end
yeah,
I was a little surprised,
badly,
too.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
no,
like,
wait, that ended,
it ended
well.
Well.
It was the last
I
good day he
it.
Had.
Yeah, it was the last good day that he had with
yeah.
them.
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
I thought, yeah, that was
and then
so,
it was like 2 years, or not 2 years
it was
like,
it was some time later. But it was lots of context so that the death of the boy meant a lot more.
Yeah.
In the book,
because
just like the relationship,
the
husband and wife, meant a lot more because we learned about them
mm-hmm.
for 100 pages
yeah.
before things started to go really shitty.
Okay, so here, I'm going to jump right to the fucking ending of this and say the ending in the movie, the visual of it was so great with Rachel, one heel on, one heel off, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I hated the eye because, you know, of course, it was like, I mean, look at Poltergeist. The special effects are obviously not anywhere like they would be now. But the thing is that I thought was so interesting about the book and the movie is it ends exactly the same. He feels her cold hand on his neck, and she says, though, in the book, my darling.
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 And I'm wondering, does it end the same? I mean, they give it to you in the movie where it's like you can hear that and that Disney scream. Like
yeah.
you can hear she grabs the knife and then they're screaming. Is there a possibility that in a multiverse of Stephen King that she actually comes back and she's not totally fucked up in the book?
Well, what's interesting in the book is that not everything that comes back is fucked up.
Right.
Remember they talk about like that one dog in the movie. That dog is totally rabid and insane
right.
and Cujo-like.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, he's okay.
He's good
he's
for a while,
stupid.
Yeah. He's stupid.
They're
but,
stupid,
mm-hmm.
and they move slower, and they're
yeah.
dumb, but most of them don't.
Exactly. Get,
and the man that they put up there and came back was the exception in that he went completely insane.
Right.
In the movie, the implication is that everything that comes back is insane.
Right.
Which is a problem, because we're looking right now at here where
Church
just scratched Lewis. And it's like, in the book, the cat is just stupid. He's not evil.
He's not mean at all. He's
no.
just, he doesn't like the smell of him, and he it's a
yes,
bad memory for Lewis, and he knows that he lied to his daughter, and so he's always like kicking the cat,
in
and
him,
she's lost interest in
but
him.
But he's not.
He's a background character.
He's not evil.
No.
So that the idea of bringing his son back
yeah.
the same way, though it's in many ways horrible,
right.
it's like, it didn't go that bad with Church. And so if I do it a day earlier and he comes back and he's smart, and even if he's
right.
dumb, at least he'll be here.
At least, yes, and that's what he thinks. He, in the book he says,
and in the context,
even if he's dumb.
Yeah, but in the context of the movie, that makes no sense. Church is totally evil
mm-hmm.
from the second he comes
right.
back. So why would you do that to your
to
son?
To your son, exactly. That's
and then
the
to
thing.
Your
mm-hmm.
wife. It's
when
like,
watching the movie, you're like, why would you do that? Now,
yeah.
the interesting thing in the book is that when Rachel dies, Gage kills Rachel. Lewis wakes up. He finds Jed. He feels so terrible. He finds his wife. He feels even worse. And he immediately takes her straight to the friggin'
yeah.
graveyard.
Yeah. And like almost calls over his shoulder. It'll be better this time. It'll be faster.
It'll be faster.
Waited too long.
And also because, I mean, and that makes sense in the book because if you think about it, if Gage was in a coffin, he's been embalmed.
Yeah.
So there's a whole issue with that. Now, Rachel will still have blood in her body, you know, and it still will be warm and this kind of thing. So I can see the rationalization of crazy, you know.
The other interesting thing is in the book, the boy is totally fucked up. His head
oh,
was almost
right.
torn from his body. He was in terrible shape. And they had to basically reconstruct him. So the body that comes back is badly damaged.
Messed up,
it's
yeah.
really messed up. In the movie, he's pristine.
Right, that's
which,
right.
Which, really got to think about, he got hit by a fucking truck.
Yeah, and we saw the shoe that was filled with blood, and they, in the book they described the cap filled with blood, which means that his head was completely...
He was, and there is some, in the book, there's a fair amount of description about how bad that kid was damaged. And when brought back, he was barely stitched back together.
Right, exactly.
Which, again, in the remake, it'll be interesting to see how far they go now that they can with CGI. How badly rattled will that horrible kid be?
Oh, my God.
Which I would find far more
terrifying
now than... Because we've seen Chucky and we've seen the cute kid go bad.
Right.
But the idea that this kid is fully fucked up.
Right. And that he still doesn't care. He wants to try it anyways. And then his wife... You know, I can't remember in the book, he stabbed her like 22 or 32 times or something with the scalpel. And so it's like these, it could just be these little things. Yeah, again, now we're watching the movie and he's going to take a nice relaxing bath. And then all of a sudden Church just like any cat would do this, throwing a rat at, no cat throws a rat at
again,
you, first
why,
of all.
If the cat is acting like this from the get, then your kid gets killed.
You do not put your kid in that cemetery.
Why would you say, oh, let's bring my kid back. It'd be totally evil.
Right.
It's like,
never.
No, I mean.
See, and I get it. Like, in the book, I get the progression. The cat is just like, whatever, dumb. You put your kid in, and you're like,
Jen
has
told
him
stories about all the animals that came back fine.
They were okay.
Or
yeah,
okay,
they were
not
just
great.
Dumb.
And there is a line in the book saying, even if he comes back in, he's dull. Even if he's not smart, at least he'll be with us. He'll
like,
be okay.
And he
we'll take care of
him. Rachel, actually, I just remember this. He asked Rachel in the book, if Gage were to be retarded, would you still love him?
Yep.
He asked that, and she said, of course I would have. And that's her way of, like, because she doesn't talk about death or deal with death, out of left field, retardation, if our son was, you know, mentally handicapped, would we still have loved him? And she's like, what are you talking about? Of course, but it takes it off of the death thing for her. And she's like, yes, of course, you know. And then he's, like, justified and, like, okay, I have every right to be thinking this, you know. Like, he'll just come back slow.
Yeah, he can convince himself that this is a good idea without being totally insane.
Yeah.
Because we had plenty of cases where they came back slow, but they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
And Church came back slow, but okay.
Right.
And he's just heard stories about this other guy and this other animal.
And
that
also that Timmy, the guy that came back and was crazy and they had to light the house on fire with the dad in it and everything like that, he had come back from a war, hadn't he?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean...
So you could talk yourself out of it.
Yes, exactly.
In the movie, why does he act this way? Why does he do these things?
Right.
It makes no sense. So you lose sympathy for them as you go. It's another super.
Okay, I wanted to talk about Missy,
Missy does not exist in the book.
She does, actually. But
not
like this, no.
I don't understand why they did this, why King wrote this scene.
Well, and also I don't understand is why when she's like, I always thought I should have married a doctor. Oh, these stomach pains, you know. And she's like talking to Rachel, and Rachel's just so like milquetoast. She's like, "Oh, okay. Well, have a good day, Missy." And I'm like, "You're married to a fucking doctor." By the way, this is the only time that
Stephen King appears as the King.
This is the what do you call it though when they're presiding over a funeral?
Eulogy, I guess.
Eulogy, thank you. That's the word.
Yeah.
The eulogist. So this is the only time I think that Stephen King, and God bless you, sir, I love you so much. If I ever meet you, I just will quickly ask you to autograph a part of my body that's not sexual, and I will go to a tattoo artist and get it
done.
There's
no part of your body that's not sexual.
Oh, thank you. Even my ankle? What about the outer part?
Oh, my God. Let's not get started.
What about my outer elbow?
Okay.
But I think that he's never looked better in any movie that he's ever done, the Alfred Hitchcock walk on. And I think that he's never done a better job at just sounding normal.
That's true. I just watched Creepshow 2.
Yeah, he does not.
Of all things. He's in the Hitchhiker episode. He plays a truck driver. Who comes? He's great.
Oh, wait, which one? Creepshow 2? Oh,
Creepshow 2.
Oh.
He's in the Hitchhiker one.
Oh.
And he's pretty good. That just became available on Shudder. If anybody wants to go see it, go watch it. It's got the raft in it.
The raft. Wait, the one that we like with the ending with the
Yep. It's in there. It's great. All of Creepshow 2 is actually way better
than
that.
When we get to talking about the raft.
Except Chief Woodenhead, which is just embarrassing in every sense.
Oh, yeah. I vaguely remember that. That was weird.
Except for one weird thing. The guy that plays the real shitty bad kid in that, a million years ago, he's still around, still acting. He was the old veteran cop in Mindhunters on...
No way.
Yeah, you would barely recognize him. He has long hair.
A child actor that didn't get all fucked up and then turns into a really hot guy. Or not hot, but
and now he's like, but you would never think, ooh, that kid's going to go somewhere. No, that's the one. He has the only one in the movie that goes anywhere. It's like really hilarious. Yeah, you could do a whole episode, nothing but the Stephen King cameos and all of his movies.
Oh, my gosh. We're going to do an episode about that.
They're increasingly stupid as they go on.
Yeah.
But there isn't any kind of character logic to the guys in the movie. They do stuff because the plot insists on it. It all makes sense in the slower build and relationships of the book.
And also the time frame that it's written in and the way marriages and things were back then.
But it doesn't really make a lot of sense in the movie.
No.
It's just, it surges forward in a lot of unfortunate ways. And then the ending, you can't really blame the movie for like the Chucky syndrome and the rest that came later. But at the time, the cute little kid, you know, with the
scalpel was
scary.
He was scary, but because he was so cute with his little top hat and everything. Oh my God, Gage.
And it's strange what still works in this movie despite everything. And that's one, you know, Fred Gwynn's performance and this whole sequence with the woman on the bed. If people remember anything about this, that's what they remember. This one sequence.
Came back for you, Rachel. I'm going to twist your back like mine so you'll never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again.
Oh, yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
And she's like 8 or something.
Yeah, and keep in mind, this was fully 30 years ago.
Oh, shit.
30 years ago.
Yeah.
This next year. And it was done in 89. There were some real possibilities with this movie. And it'll be really interesting to see in the remake
now,
if
what
they go back.
Now, what do you think the remake is going to come out?
Oh, it's scheduled for 2019. So
good. So it's being cast now.
It's being made now.
This episode of The Dark Multiverse of Stephen King is brought to you by Sharp Cereal and Red Raspberry Zingers, the breakfast treat that every kid can't get enough of. And here's a special message just for you.
Hey kids, it's the Sharp Cereal Professor with a special message for my biggest fan, that's you. Hey there, don't you love Red Raspberry Zingers? They're the super scarlet cereal that totally fills you up with the big red boost of extra energies that every kid needs. And I know for a fact that you just can't get enough of those zingers. You'll just want to eat some and eat some and eat some until... But hey, Mom, make sure it's part of a balanced breakfast, verstehens Sie? So, take it from the Sharp Cereal Professor. That's me. There's nothing wrong here. Have that second bowl of Red Raspberry Zingers. You know you want them. They're bloody delicious.
That's Red Raspberry Zingers from Sharp Cereal. On sale now at your local Federal Foods. Check out the discounts in our Bridgeton, Maine store while there's still time.
Do you think the movie's worth watching, even with
all of this? Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I definitely do. I love just the story. I mean, if you don't know it, it's one of those things where it's like, it's definitely worth a watch. And I showed it to my husband, who's not necessarily like a Stephen King fan or something. Yeah. I'm sure he's seen this movie before, but if he had never seen it, he'd be like, okay, I have to put in the 80s acting and the 80s ways of shooting things and all that kind of stuff. But it's a good movie. I like it. I think it's a good movie.
Yeah, I would say that if for nothing else, for Fred Gwynn's performance and for the Zelda series, I think this is worth the hour and a half. If you really want to enjoy this book in its full glory, listen to the damn audiobook.
The audiobook is so great.
Michael C. Hall performances and the book itself. The book is so much richer and smarter than we remember. Than I remember.
Yeah.
I remember it as kind of one of his light ones. No, it is as serious and deep a book about men and women, husbands and wives, fathers and sons, yeah, mm-hmm. all that stuff, and about death itself and our fear of it, also, as anything he's written. It's really good.
He has a more father-son relationship with Jed in that he's like, oh my God, we're friends, and I also see him as like my dad, and it's, I thought that was really kind of cool. He just like glinted on it, and it wasn't like a, you know, in-depth thing. It just like...
It wasn't a prop, too, and of course, yes. We'll see this with King forever. He writes about characters that are about the same age as in his life. So mm-hmm. when he wrote
right.
about these little kids, he had sons that were two years old.
Speaking of which, okay, so that's something that we need to talk about. So there's the scene in the book when Gage dies. He has this whole thing where he talks about how he sees Gage growing up. And that, to me, was the best part of the book. I mean, it really, really was, because it's like, it's so... visceral and so emotional, like you feel yeah.
that little section where he imagines going to Disney World and running back into the
yeah.
devil, basically,
yeah.
there, death stalking Disney World. It's so beautiful,
and
it's
about
so
him becoming
freakish.
An Olympic swimmer as he's in college, and
right.
the girl that he marries, and he just basically so detailed in the way that Stephen King is so good, where I get really bored if he's describing curtains for three pages of a room, but you know, this was like. I think it was like two pages of like just the most gorgeous, like how he saw his son growing up and mm-hmm. how at this point, I think in the book, he's very clinical about it because he already knows that he's going to do it. You know, it's
yeah.
already been toying with the idea. And so it's almost like you feel as the reader, the constant reader, the emotion of what that would be like to experience the loss of your son and then go through all these stages of what you would see your kid doing in Disneyland and the marriage and becoming an Olympic swimmer.
And going off and stalking death everywhere and doing all these great things with
yes.
him. What's also interesting is what's not there. What's not there is his wife or his daughter.
Right.
It's just him
it's
and
just
his boy.
Engaged.
And there's this wonderful echo of the end of Salem's Lot where
yes.
the boy and the man are
yes.
off, you know,
mm-hmm.
killing vampires
yeah.
elsewhere.
Sure.
It's a recurring fantasy of King's.
And especially because the reason why he wrote Pet Sematary is because Owen almost got hit by a truck on a road mm-hmm. like that when they moved into a house or a trailer or something like that. And there was a road nearby. And the neighbor did say, you know, if this is
yep.
death and keep your kids away from this, Owen almost got killed on the road. And so the For Owen story is about swimming and the fact that he talks about when he gets into college and he's an Olympic swimmer after that and all that. It was just like you knew he was just reliving that exact moment over again. And it just really gut punches you in the best way possible.
Yeah. So, yeah, I agree. I think there are some really worthwhile things here. But if you really want to get into it,
listen to the audiobook. Go get in your garden or wash your car, do whatever, put your earbuds in and just do it.
Okay, it's time for the Castle Rock Skeleton Key. We're not going to talk about the plot of every episode. We're going to do at least one episode about Castle Rock when the whole first season is done.
Right.
But in the meantime, every week, let's talk about one episode and all of the dark multiverse connections
yes.
that are in that episode.
I love it.
So first up, obviously, is episode one. So
you think?
Because I can count.
You're very good
I'm
at it.
I'm really good.
What
I
comes after that?
I don't know. I learned it when I was very young. About one. So what is one of the multiverse things you notice?
Okay, so of course the first thing would be the music that Warden Lacey plays on his way to his own suicide. It's the same as the music that Andy Dufresne plays in Shawshank, which I love it when those two Italian women sing.
Yeah, and I looked it up. It's actually from The Marriage of Figaro. It's Che Suave Zaffretto.
I don't know how to say that, but yes.
Yes, that's what it is.
It's those two Italian ladies.
I wouldn't know it if I heard it.
As soon as it started, though, I grabbed Brad's knee and I was like, it's Shawshank. And then
And that's like in the first 3 minutes
yeah.
of the damn thing.
And then afterwards, it actually shows the prison and it kind of has the music like it did. And then it just kind of has this more ominous tone building. And then that takes over. It's very cool.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, the major thing for me, the first thing up was the appearance of Alan Pangborn,
mm-hmm.
who's been in a bunch of the Castle Rock stuff all the way along. He's a major part. Obviously, he's the center of Needful Things.
Yeah.
He's also at the center of
the Dark Half.
Dark Half. And we've seen him at different places in his life, and now we see him as an old...
And he's still around.
...washed-up guy. Also, we see him in a younger version when he actually finds Deaver.
And I wonder what it is that he heard.
Yeah, and he left town for a while, and he came back, and we're just going to learn a lot more about
mm-hmm.
it. But Pangborn being here very much puts us right in the middle of
modern day Castle Rock.
Yes, it does. And what's the name of the actor that plays him?
That's Scott Glenn.
Oh, I love him.
Most recently seen as playing Stick on the Daredevil Netflix show.
Oh, okay.
But he's been around doing brilliant work for long. And he looks so old and so wasted and so perfect.
But he still looks exactly the same in his own way. I love it. He's
I think he's great. I think he's a great actor.
I love though. Okay, so speaking of Shawshank Redemption for one second. There's that part in the beginning when they walk into, so they're introducing the new warden to Lacey's office, and they're like, so anyways, yeah, this warden and blah, 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 this warden and blah, blah, blah. And then you can still see the bullet hole where that warden, and she's like, I don't need the history or whatever.
I'm cool. I love that. Yeah. She's great. So many of the actors in this are so good.
And
one of the wonderful little meta things is whoever thought this up of using a bunch of people that are famous for their Stephen King connection just from the other movies they were in.
Yes.
Most obvious is Sissy Spacek.
Of course.
And from Carrie way back in the day.
It's so awesome to see her as a woman, like if Carrie would have lived, you know, like, and she was just in Castle Rock and crazy.
Yeah, she's got this beautiful kind of broken beauty. So you could see how gorgeous she was when she was younger and still is, but she's so distracted and torn apart.
She's so mentally ill at this point with her sundown
really
and whatnot.
Great. The others, I think, aren't quite as well. Obviously, Bill Skarsgård playing the kid, who is Pennywise in the new It.
I love that, you know, I don't know where this is going yet, but the eye is doing the exact same thing that Pennywise was, where he has the lazy eye where he can make one look at the audience and one look at you. Sorry, I just have to throw that out there.
No, I agree. Whether he's playing somebody completely unconnected to Pennywise or whether he's playing
whether it's just a nod or it's a connection.
We don't know yet. One that's clearly just a nod I like is Frances Conroy.
Yeah,
she plays Warden Lacey's wife. And of course, she was in The Mist, the program we hate but watch.
Right.
And she's only in, I think, two scenes, really. Her character disappears. But she's wonderful in both of them and almost unrecognizable as the woman who played the old hippie woman who
got naked and went out into nature.
And in the first half of The Mist, she was wonderful, and then they completely screwed up
everything. Right. Well, they screwed up everything when they thought they were getting signed for a second season.
Who else?
Then we have Terry O'Quinn from Silver Bullet, which I still have not seen.
Terry O'Quinn is one of the greatest character actors in suspense movies in the history of time.
I didn't know that.
The first one I remember was
So what
the
character
stepfather.
Is he? Have I? Oh, of course. Oh my God. He's Locke from Mist. He's Locke from Lost. Sorry.
Yeah. And he was also in a short-lived series called 666 Park Avenue. It was an ABC series about a haunted hotel.
Okay.
He played one of the two owners in that.
Okay.
He's done a million things.
I've seen him in a lot of different things, but I never loved him until Lost. I mean,
I've loved him seriously since The Stepfather, the film version of the Donald Westlake.
That was a good movie. That was
screenplay.
Scary.
It was
creepy.
Great. And everything he's done since, I've loved him ever since. He doesn't look like a movie star. He looks like a regular guy.
That's the thing. I think that's why he's so perfect to blend in, but his eyes are so intense.
Yeah, and
he's got very intense eyes when he wants to be, and also
totally
very sweet puppy dog eyes when he wants to be.
Yeah. And and then, of course, the last one.
And his voiceover, too, is really good.
Yeah, and that continues for many weeks to come. But Melanie Lynskey is the other one. She's the across the street neighbor, the psychic
of Henry Deavers,
and who again becomes real important as time goes on. But she was in Rose Red.
I loved her in Rose Red.
And she
as
was also
for protecting
a few,
that crazy
few
girl.
Seasons. She was the stalker next door neighbor in A 2.5 Men.
Oh, really? So she's basically playing the same role.
Yeah, except she wasn't psychic in 2.5 Men.
Okay.
And it was played completely for laughs, having a sitcom. So to see her here, and the more you see of her, the more you realize, oh, not only is she a stalker, she's a true psychic stalker.
Yeah.
Of that
she has a lot of range then between 2.5 Men and comedy and then doing a stalker.
And she's
psychic.
So convincing in this. She's so natural.
So far that I've seen, she really is.
And we talked about this. In general, the acting in this is all amazing.
It really
it's
has
so
been.
Not over the top.
The guy that plays Deaver, his face, the way it changes, I just love it. Like, you can see everything without a word. It's like his face is a picture. It's worth a thousand.
And her, too. She, without, you know, it would be easy to think, oh, it's Stephen King. I can go big. You know,
right.
I can be very overactive and chew the scenery, and nobody's doing that.
Nobody's really going over the top. It's all very subtle, and
very
it's
subtle.
Actually the way Stephen King writes his characters. They all start out subtle, and then it's either the dark underside that you eventually learn, or it becomes over-the-top crazy. And it never starts out that way. However, the movies are always projecting it that way. It's just boom, 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 crazy, crazy, crazy.
Yeah.
And then, or gory, 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 and lame.
Yeah. Well, that's
that's it.
That's most of the good links we know of in episode one of this. And we'll come back next week and talk about all of the dark multiverse things for episode two. And that's it for our two-parter on Pet Sematary in all its various incarnations. Get our show notes and transcripts at darkmultipod.com. Join us on Twitter at darkmultipod or on Instagram at, strangely enough, darkmultipod, where we'll also remind you about what we're talking about in the next show. And we do take requests, too, so drop us a note. Our beautiful theme and bed music is under us right now. Listen. It's used by the generous permission of Chrysanthi Tan, a brilliant musician, composer, and performer. You can visit her website at chrysanthitan.com. That's spelled like chrysanthemum, but without the mum at the end. Yeah, well, there's a link on our website to it, too. And you can become one of her very lucky supporters over on Patreon as well. You can follow Brad at TheBradMunson on Twitter or TheBradMunson on Instagram. Kat, meanwhile, well, she thinks social media were created by the Illuminati as part of a dark conspiracy to control all of humanity, so there's that. Sorry. Thanks for joining us. We're having a great time. We hope you are, too. And, of course, we'd love you to subscribe, like, leave reviews, tell your king-obsessed friends and neighbors, and, of course, lend me $20 until next payday, because I'm your best friend ever. See you next time.
The barrier was not meant to be crossed. The ground is sour.